Rumpole and the Children of the Devil. Sometimes, when I have nothing better to occupy my mind, when I'm sitting in the bath, for instance, or in the doctor's surgery, having exhausted the entertainment value of last year's country life, or when I'm seated in the corner of Pomeroy's wine bar, waiting for some generous spirit in chambers, and there aren't many of them left, to come in and say, "Care for a glass of Chateau Fleet Street, Rumpole?" I wonder what I would have done if I had been God. I mean, if I had been responsible for creating the world in the first place. Would I have cobbled up a globe entirely without the minus quantities we have grown used to? A place with no fatal diseases or traffic jams or Mr. Justice Graves and one or two others I could mention? Above all, would I have created a world entirely without evil? And when I come to think rather further along these lines, it seems to me that a world without evil might possibly be a damn dull world. Or an undamned dull world, perhaps I should say. And it would certainly be a world which would leave Rumpole without an occupation. It would also put the old Bill and most of Her Majesty's judges, prosecutors, prison officers and screws on the breadline. So, perhaps a world where everyone rushes about doing good to each other, and everyone, including the aforesaid Graves, is filled with brotherly love, is not such a marvellous idea after all. Brooding a little further on this business of evil, it occurs to me that the world is fairly equally divided between those who see it everywhere, because they're always looking for it, and those who hardly notice it at all. Of course, the mere fact that some people recognise devilment in the most everyday matters doesn't mean that it isn't there. I have known the first indication that evil was present in various cases that I've been concerned with. A missing library ticket, a car tyre punctured, or the wrong overcoat taken from the cloakroom of an expensive restaurant. At other times, the signs of evil are so blatant that they're impossible to ignore. As in the dramatic start to the case which I have come to think of as concerning the Children of the Devil. They led to a serious and at times painful inquiry into the machinations of Satan in the borough of Crockthorpe. Crockthorpe is a large, sprawling, in many parts dejected, in others rather too cosy for comfort area, south of the Thames. Its inhabitants include people speaking many languages, many without jobs, many gainfully employed in legal and not-so-legal businesses, and the huge Timpson clan, which must by now account for a sizable chunk of the population. The Timpsons, as those of you who have followed my legal career in detail will know, provide not only the bread and marge, the vim and brasso, but quite often the beef and butter of our life in Froxbury Mansions, Gloucester Road. A proportion of my intake of Chateau Thames Embankment and my wife Hilda's gin and tonic comes thanks to the tireless activities of the Timpson family. They are such a large group, their crime rate is so high, and their success rate so comparatively low, that they are perfect clients for an Old Bailey hack. They go in for theft, shop-breaking, and receiving stolen property, but they have never produced a master crook. If you're looking for sensational crimes, the Timpsons won't provide it. Or, it would be more accurate to say, they didn't, until the day that Tracy Timpson apparently made a pact with the devil. The story began in the playground of Crockthorpe's Stafford Cripps Junior School. The building had not been much repaired since it was built in the heady days of the first post-war Labour government, and the playground had been kicked to pieces by generations of scuffling under-12s. It was during the mid-morning break when the children were out fighting, ganging up on each other, or unhappy because they had no one to play with. Among the most active, and about to pick a fight with a far larger black boy, was Dominic Molloy, angel-faced and Irish, who will figure in this narrative. Well, as I say, it was halfway through break, and the headmistress, a certain Miss Appleyard, a woman in her early 40s who would have been beautiful had not the stress of life in the Stafford Cripps Jr., aged her prematurely, was walking across the playground, trying to work out how to make 50 copies of the Little Green Reading Book go round 200 pupils, when she heard the sound of concerted, eerie, and high-pitched screaming coming from one of the doors that led onto the playground. Turning towards the sound of the outcry, Miss Appleyard saw a strange sight. A small posse of children, about 9 of them, all girls and all screaming, came rushing out like a charge of miniature cavalry. Who they were was, at this moment, a mystery to the headmistress, for each child wore a similar mask. Above the dresses and the jeans and the pullovers hung the scarlet and black grimacing and evil faces of 9 devils. At this sight, even the bravest and most unruly children in the playground were taken aback. Many retreated, some of the younger ones adding to the chorus of screams. Only young Dominic Molloy, it has to be said, stood his ground and viewed the scene that followed with amusement and contempt. He saw Miss Appleyard step forward fearlessly, and when the charge halted, she plucked off the devil's mask and revealed the small, heart-shaped face of the 8-year-old Tracy, almost the youngest, and now apparently the most devilish of the Timpson family. Events thereafter took an even more sinister turn. At first the headmistress looked grim, confiscated the masks, and ordered the children back to the classroom, but didn't speak to them again about their extraordinary demonstration. Unfortunately, she laid the matter before the proper authority, which in this case was the Social Services and Welfare Department of the Crockthorpe Council. So the wheels were set in motion that would end up with young Tracy Timpson being taken into what is laughingly known as care. This being the punishment meted out to children who failed to conform to a conventional and rational society. Childhood has, I regret to say, like much else, got worse since I was a boy. We had school bullies, we had headmasters who were apparently direct descendants of Captain Bligh of the Bounty, we had cold baths, inedible food, and long hours in chapel on Sundays. But there was one compensation. No one had invented social workers. Now, British children, it seems, can expect the treatment we once thought was only meted out to the political opponents of the late unlamented Joseph Stalin. They must learn to dread the knock at the door, the tramp of the old bill up the stairs, and being snatched away from their nearest and dearest by a member of the alleged caring professions. The dreaded knock was to be heard at 6:30 one morning on the door of the semi in Morrison Close, where that young couple, Carrie and Rosemary, known as Roz Timpson, lived with Tracy, their only child. There was a police car flashing its blue light outside the house, and a woman police constable in uniform on the step. The knock was administered by a social worker named Mirabel Jones, of whom we'll hear considerably more later. She was a perfectly pleasant-looking girl, with well-tended hair, who wore, whenever I saw her, a linen jacket and a calf-length skirt of some ethnic material. When she spoke, she modulated her naturally posh tones into some semblance of a working-class accent, and she always referred to the parents of the children who came into her possession as Mum and Dad, and spoke with friendliness and deep concern. When the knock sounded, Tracy was asleep, in the company of someone known as Barbie Doll, which I have since discovered to be a miniature American person with a beehive hairdo and a large wardrobe. Carrie Timpson was pounding down the stairs in his pyjamas, unhappily convinced that the knock was in some way connected with a break-in at a shop in Gunston Avenue, about which he had been repeatedly called in for questioning, although he had made it clear on each occasion that he knew absolutely bugger all about it. By the time he had pulled open the door, his wife, Roz, had appeared on the stairs behind him. So she was able to hear Mirabel telling her husband, after the parties had identified each other, that she had come about young Tracy. From the statements, which I was able to read later, it appears that the dialogue then went something like this. It began with a panic-stricken cry from Roz of, "Tracy? What about Tracy? She's asleep upstairs. Isn't she asleep upstairs?" "Are you mum?" Mirabel then asked. "What do you mean, am I mum? Of course I'm Tracy's mum. What do you want?" Roz clearly spoke with rising hysteria, and Mirabel's reply sounded, as always, reasonable. "We want to look after your Tracy, mum. We feel she needs rather special care. I'm sure you're both going to help us. We do rely on Mum and Dad to be very sensible." Roz was not deceived by the soothing tones and concerned smile. She got the awful message, and the shock of it brought her coldly to her senses. "You come to take Tracy away, haven't you?" And before the question was answered, she shouted, "You're not bloody taking her away. We just want to do the very best for your little girl, that's all, Mum." At which Mirabel detached a dreaded, official-looking document from the clipboard she was carrying. "We do have a court order. Now, shall we go and wake Tracy up? Ever so gently." It would be unnecessarily painful to dwell on the scene that followed. Roz fought like a tigress for her young, and had to be restrained, at first by her husband, who had learnt, as a juvenile, the penalty for assaulting the powers of justice, and then by the uniformed officer who was called in from the car. The Timpsons were told they would be able to argue the case in court eventually. The woman police officer helped pack a few clothes for Tracy in a small case, and as the child was removed from the house, Mirabel took the Barbie doll from her, explaining that it was bad for children in such circumstances to have too many things that reminded them of home. So young Tracy Timpson was taken into custody, and her parents came nearer to heartbreak than they ever had in their lives. Even when Carrie got a totally unexpected 2 years for the theft of a clapped-out Volvo estate from Safeway's car park. Throughout it all, it's fair to say that Miss Mirabel Jones behaved with the tact and consideration which made her such a star of the social services and such a dangerous witness in the juvenile court. Tracy Timpson was removed to a gloomy Victorian villa, now known as the Lilacs, Crockthorpe Council Children's Home, where she will stay for the remainder of this story. And Mirabel set out to interview what she called Tracy's peers, by which she meant the other kids Tracy was at school with. And, in the course of her activities, she called at another house in Morrison Close, this one being occupied by the father and mother of young Dominic Molloy. Now, anyone who knows anything about the world we live in, anyone who keeps his or her ear to the ground and picks up as much information as possible about family rivalry in the Crockthorpe area, will know that the Molloys and the Timpsons are chalk and cheese, and as deadly rivals as the Montagues and the Capulets, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, or York and Lancaster. The Molloys are an extended family. They are also villains, but of a far more purposeful and efficient variety. To the Timpsons' record of small-time thieving, the Molloys add wounding, grievous bodily harm, and an occasional murder. Now, Mirabel called on the 8-year-old Dominic Molloy, and after a preliminary consultation with him and his parents, he agreed to help her with her inquiries. This, in turn, led to a further interview in an office at the school with young Dominic, which was immortalized on video. I remember my first conference with Tracy's parents, because on that morning, Hilda and I had a slight difference of opinion on the subject of the Scales of Justice ball. This somewhat grisly occasion is announced annually on a heavily embossed card, which arrived with the gas bill and various invitations to insure my life and go on Mediterranean cruises, on the Rumpole breakfast table. I had launched this invitation towards the tidy bin to join the tea leaves and the eggshells when Hilda, whose eagle eye misses nothing, immediately retrieved it, shook various particles of food off it, and challenged me with, "And why are you throwing this away, Rumble?" "You don't want to go, Hilda," I did my best to persuade her. "Disgusting sight, Her Majesty's judges creaking round in the foxtrot at the Savoy Hotel. You wouldn't enjoy it." "I suppose not, Rumpel. Not in the circumstances." "Not in what circumstances?" "It's too humiliating." "I quite agree." I saw her point at once. "When Mr. Justice Graves breaks into the Valita, I hang my head in shame." "It's humiliating for me, Rumpel, when other chaps in chambers lead their wives out onto the floor." "Not a pretty sight, I have to agree. The waltzing Bullards, the pirouetting Erskine Browns." "Why do you never lead me onto the dance floor nowadays, Rumpel?" She asked me the question direct. "I sometimes dream about it. We're at the Scales of Justice Ball at the Savoy Hotel, and you lead me out onto the floor as the first lady in chambers." "You are, Hilda," I hastened to agree with her. "You're quite definitely the senior." "But you never lead me out, Rumpel. We have to sit there, staring at each other across the table, while all around us couples are dancing the night away." "Hilda," I decided to disclose my defence, "I have, as you know, many talents, but I am not Nijinsky. Anyway, we don't get much practice at dancing down the Old Bailey." "Oh, it doesn't matter. When is the ball? Marigold Featherstone told me, but I can't quite remember." I saw with a sort of dread that she was checking the food-stained invitation to answer her question. "November, the 18th. It just happens to be my birthday. Well, we'll stay at home, as usual. At least I won't have to sit and watch other happy people dancing together." And now she applied the corner of her handkerchief to her eye. "Please, Hilda," I begged, "not the waterworks." At which she sniffed bravely and dismissed me from her presence. "No, of course not. Go along now. You've got to get to work. Work's the only thing that matters to you. You'd rather defend the murderer than dance with your wife." "Well, yes, perhaps," I had to admit. "Look, do cheer up, old thing, please." She gave me her last lament as I moved towards the door. "Old, yes, I suppose. We're both too old for a party, and I'll just have to get used to the fact that I didn't marry a dancer." "Sorry, Hilda." So I left She Who Must Be Obeyed sitting alone in the kitchen and looking, as I thought, genuinely unhappy. I had seen her miffed before. I had seen her outraged. I had seen her all too frequently intensely displeased at some item of Rumpel's behaviour which fell short of perfection. But I was unprepared for the sadness which seemed to have engulfed her. Had she spent her life imagining she was Ginger Rogers, and was she at last reconciled for the fact that I had neither the figure nor the top hat to play whatever his name was in Astaire? For a moment a sensation to which I am quite unused came over me. I felt inadequate. However, I pulled myself together and pointed myself in the direction of my chambers in the temple, where I knew I had a conference with a couple of Timpsons, in what I imagined would be no more than a routine case of petty thievery. I had acted for Carrie before in a little matter of lead removed from the roof of Crockthorpe Methodist Church. He was tall and thin, and usually spoke in a slow, mocking way, as though he found the whole of life slightly amusing. He didn't look amused now. His wife, Roz, was a solid girl in her late 20s, with broad cheekbones and capable hands. In attendance was the faithful Mr. Bernard, who from time immemorial has acted as Solicitor General to the Timpson family.
They wouldn't let Tracy take even a doll. Not one of her Barbies. How do you think people could do that to a child?
Roz asked me when Mr. Bernard had outlined the facts of the case. Her eyes were red and swollen, and as she sat in my client's chair, nervously twisting her wedding ring, she looked not much older than a child herself.
Nicking your kid, that's what it comes to.
Well, I'll allow us Timpsons may have done a fair bit of mischief in our time, but no one in the family's ever stooped to that, Mr. Rumpole. And Carrie Timpson added for greater emphasis, people what nick kids get boiling cocoa poured on their heads when they're inside, like.
Carrie worships that girl, Mr. Rumpole,
Roz told me,
no matter what they say.
Take a look at these. Her husband was already pulling out his wallet, and you'll see the reason why. So the brightly coloured snaps were laid proudly on my desk, and I saw the three of them on a Spanish beach at a theme park, or on days out in the country. The mother and father held their child aloft in the manner of successful athletes, with a golden prize, triumphantly, and with unmistakable delight.
Bloody marvellous, isn't it?
Carrie's gentle mocking had turned to genuine anger. 8 years old, and our Trace needs a brief.
You'll get Tracy back for us, won't you, Mr. Rumpole?
I thought Roz must have given birth to this much-loved daughter when she was about 17.
She'll be that unhappy.
You've seen the photos, Mr. Rumpole?
Carrie asked, does she have the look of a villain?
I'd say not a hardened criminal, and I had to admit.
What's her crime, Mr. Rumpole? That's what Roz and I wants to know. It's not as though she nicked things, ever.
Well, not really. And Roz admitted,
she'll have a Jaffa cake when I'm not looking, or a few sweets occasionally.
Our Trace is too young for any serious nicking. Her father was sure of it.
What do you reckon she done, Mr. Rumpole? What they got on her charge sheet?
Childhood itself seems a crime to some people. It's a point that has often struck me.
We can't seem to get any sense out of that Miss Jones.
Roz looked helpless.
Jones? Officer in charge of case. Tracy's social worker.
One of the caring community. I was sure of it.
All she'll say is that she's making further inquiries, Mr. Bernard told me.
I never discovered what I'd done when they banged me up in a drafty great boarding school at the age of 8. I looked back down the long corridor of years and began to reminisce.
Hear that, Roz?
Carrie turned to his wife.
They banged up Mr. Rumpole when he was a kid.
Did they, Mr. Rumpole? Did they really? But before I could give them further and better particulars of the bird I had done at Linklater's, that down-market public school I attended on the Norfolk coast, Mr. Bernard brought us back to the fantastic facts of the case and the nature of the charges against Tracy.
I've been talking to the solicitor for the local authority, he reported, and their case is that the juvenile Timpson has been indulging in devil worship, hellish rituals and satanic rites.
It might be convenient if I were to give you an account of that filmed interview with Dominic Malloy, which, as I have told you, we finally saw at the trial. Before that, Mr. Bernard had acquired a transcript of this dramatic scene. So we were, by bits and pieces, made aware of the bizarre charges against young Tracy, a case which began to look as though it should be transferred from Crockthorpe Juvenile Court to Seville, to be decided by hooded masks and cowled inquisitors in the darkest days of the Spanish Inquisition. The scene was set in the headmistress's office in Stafford Cripps Junior. Mirabel Jones, at her most reassuring, sat smiling on one side of the desk, while young Dominic Malloy, beaming with self-importance, played the starring role on the other.
You remember the children wearing those horrid masks at school, do you, Dominic?
Mirabel kicked off the proceedings.
They scared me.
Dominic gave a realistic shudder.
I'm sure they did.
The social worker made a note,
gave the camera, no doubt installed in a corner of the room, the benefit of her smile, and then returned to the work in hand.
Did you see who was leading those children?
In the end, I did.
Who was it?
Trace.
Tracy Timpson?
Yes.
Your mum said you went round to Tracy Timpson's a few times.
After school, was that?
Yes, after school-like.
And then you said you went somewhere else?
Where else, exactly?
Where do they put people?
A churchyard.
Was it a churchyard?
Mirabel gave us a classic example of a leading question. Dominic nodded approval, and she made a note.
The one in Crockthorpe Road, the church past the roundabout, St. Elphick's?
Mirabel suggested, and Dominic nodded again.
It was the churchyard. Was it dark?
Dominic nodded so eagerly that his whole body seemed to rock backwards and forwards, and he seemed in danger of falling off his chair.
After school and late? A month ago?
So it was dark.
Did a grown-up come with you? A man, perhaps? Did a man come with you?
He said he was to play a game.
Now Dominic had resorted to a kind of throaty whisper, guaranteed to make the flesh creep.
What sort of game? We put something on his face.
A mask?
Red, and horns on it.
A devil's mask?
Mirabel was scribbling enthusiastically.
Is that right, Dominic? He wanted you to play at devils, this man did?
He said he was the devil, yes.
He was to be the devil. And what were you supposed to be?
Dominic didn't answer that, but sat as if afraid to move.
Perhaps you were the devil's children?
At this point, Dominic's silence was more effective than any answer.
What was the game you had to play?
Mirabel tried another approach.
Dance around.
The answer came in a whisper.
Dance around? Now, I want you to tell me, Dominic, when did you meet this man? At Tracy Timpson's house? Is that where you met him?
More silence from Dominic. So Mirabel tried again.
Do you know who he was, Dominic?
At which Dominic nodded and looked round fearfully.
Who was he, Dominic? You've been such a help to me so far. Can't you tell me who he was?
Tracy's dead.
Everything changes, and with ever-increasing rapidity. Human beings no longer sell tickets at the Temple Tube Station. Machines and not disillusioned waitresses dispense the so-called coffee in the Old Bailey canteen. And when I became aware that Diane, our long-time typist and close personal friend to Henry, our clerk, had left the service, I feared and expected that she might be replaced by a robot. However, what I found behind the typewriter, when I blew into the clerk's room after a hard day's work on an actual bodily harm in Acton, a few weeks after my conference with Tracy's parents, I saw nothing more mechanical than an unusually pretty and very young woman, wearing a skirt as short as a suspended sentence, and a smile so ready that it seemed never to leave her features entirely, but to be waiting around for the next opportunity to beam. Henry introduced her as Miss Clapton. Taken over from Diane, Mr. Rumple, who's just got herself married. I don't know if you've heard the news.
Married? Henry, I'm sorry.
To a junior clerk in a bankruptcy set.
He spoke with considerable disgust.
I told her she'd live to regret it.
Welcome to Equity Court, Miss Clapton, I said. If you behave really well, you might get parole in about 10 years.
She gave me the smile at full strength.
But my attention was diverted by the sight of Miss Probert, who had just picked up a brief from the mantelpiece and was looking at it with every sign of rapture.
Liz, the daughter of Red Ron Probert, Labour leader on the Crockthorpe Council, is the most radical member of our chambers. I greeted her with, "Soft, you know, the fair Miss Probert." "What are you fondling there, old thing?"
or words to that effect.
What does it look like, Rumpole?
It looks suspiciously like a brief.
Got it in one.
Miss Liz was in perky mood that morning. Time marches on. My ex-pupil has begun to acquire briefs. What is it? Bad case of non-renewed dog license?
A bit more serious than that. I'm for the Crockthorpe Local Authority, Rumpole.
I'm suitably overawed.
I didn't ask whether the presence of Red Ron on the council had anything to do with this manner from heaven, and Miss Liz went on to tell a familiar story. A little girl had to be taken into care. She's in terrible danger in the home. You know what it is? The father's got a criminal record. As a matter of fact, it's a name that might be familiar to you. Timson.
So they took away a Timson child because the father's got form?
I asked innocently,
hoping for further information.
Not just that. Something rather awful was going on. Devil worship. The family were deeply into it, quite seriously. It's a shocking case.
Is it really?
Tell me, do you believe in the devil?
Of course I don't, Rumpole. Don't be so ridiculous.
Anyway, that's hardly the point.
Isn't it? It interests me, though. You see, I'm likely to be against you in the juvenile court.
You, Rumpole, on the side of the devil?
Miss Probert seemed genuinely shocked.
Why not? They tell me he has the best lines. Defending devil worshippers in a children's case? That's really not on, is it, Rumpole?
I really can't think of anyone I wouldn't defend. That's what I believe in. I was just on my way to Pomeroy's. Miss Liz, old thing. They joined me in a stiffener.
I don't really think we should be seen drinking together. Not now I'm appealing for the local authority.
For the local authority, of course.
I gave her a respectful bow on leaving.
A great power in the land, even if they do rather interfere with the joy of living. No sooner had I got to Pomeroy's wine bar and chalked up the first glass of Jack Pomeroy's Very Ordinary, when Claude Erskine Brown of our chambers came into view in a state of considerable excitement about the new typist.
An enormous asset, don't you think? Dot will bring a flood of spring sunshine into our clerk's room.
Dot, I was puzzled.
What are you babbling about?
Her name's Dot, Rumpole. She told me that. I said it was a beautiful name.
I didn't need to tell the fellow he was making a complete ass of himself. This was a fact too obvious to mention.
I've told her she must come to me, if she has any problems work-wise.
Claude is, of course, married to Phillida Erskine Brown, QC, the attractive and highly competent Portia of our chambers. Perhaps it's because he has to play second fiddle to this powerful advocate that Claude is forever on the lookout for alternative company, a pursuit which brings little but embarrassment to himself and those around him. I saw nothing but trouble arising from the appearance of this Dot upon the Erskine Brown horizons. But now the fellow completely changed the subject and said,
"You know Charlie Wisbeach?"
"I've never heard of him."
"Wisbeach, Bottomley, Perkins and Harris?"
Erskine Brown spoke in an awestruck whisper as though repeating a magic formula. "Good God, are they all here?"
"I rather think Claude's talking about my dad's firm."
This came from a plumpish but fairly personable young man who was in the offing, holding a bottle of champagne and a glass, which he now refilled, and also gave a shower of bubbles to Erskine Brown.
"Just the best firm in the city, Rumpole. Quality work. And Charlie here's come to the bar. He wants a seat in chambers."
Erskine Brown sounded remarkably keen on the idea, no doubt hoping for work for the firm of Wisbeach, Bottomley, Perkins and Harris.
"Oh, yes?" I sniffed danger. "And where would he like it?
There might be an inch or two available in the downstairs loo. Didn't we decide we were full up at the last chambers meeting?"
"I say, must be old Rumpole."
Young Wisbeach was looking at me as though I were some extinct species still on show in the Natural History Museum. "I'm afraid I've got very little choice in the matter," I had to admit.
"You're not still practicing, are you?"
Charlie Wisbeach had the gall to ask.
"Not really.
I suppose I've learnt how to do it by now. Oh, but Claude Erskine Brown told me you'd soon be retiring. Did you, Claude? Did you tell young Charlie that? I turned upon the treacherous Erskine Brown the searchlight eyes and spoke in the pained tones of the born cross-examiner. Well, no, not exactly, Rumpel. The man fumbled for words. Well, of course, I just assumed you'd be retiring sometime. Don't count on it, Erskine Brown. Don't you ever count on it. And Claude told me that when you retired, old chap, there might be a little space in your chambers. The usurper Wisbeach apparently found the situation amusing. A pretty enormous space is what I think he said. Didn't you, Claude? Well, now, Charlie, not quite. Erskine Brown's embarrassment proved his guilt. It sounds like an extremely humorous conversation. I gave them both a look contemptuous. Charlie has a pretty impressive CV, Rumpole. Erskine Brown tried to change the subject as his newfound friend gave him another slurp. See what? Curriculum vitae. Eaten. Oh, good at that as well, is he? I thought it was mainly drinking. Claude's probably referring to the old school. Wisbeach could not, of course, grasp the Rumpole joke. Oh, Eton. Well, I've no doubt you'll soon rise above the handicaps of a deprived childhood in somebody else's chambers. As a matter of fact, Claude showed me your room. Wisbeach gave the damning evidence. Very attractive accommodation. You did what, Claude? Charlie and I, well, we called in to see you, but you were doing that long arson in Snaresbrook. Historic spot, your room, Wisbeach told me, as though I'd never seen the place before. Fine views over the churchyard. Don't you look straight down at Dr. Johnson's tomb? It's Oliver Goldsmith's, as it so happens. Eton seemed to have done little for the man's state of essential knowledge. No, Johnson's. You can't tell an old Etonian anything. Goldsmith, I repeated, with the last of my patience. Want to bet? Not particularly. Your old room needs a good deal of decorating, of course, and some decent furniture, but the idea is we might share while you're still practicing, Rumpole. That's not an idea. It's a bad dream. I directed my rejection of the offer at Erskine Brown, who started up a babble of, Rumpole, think of the work that Wisbeach could send us. And I would like to let it be known that I still have work to do, and I do it best alone, as a free spirit. Wrongs are still to be righted. Here I drained my plonk to the dregs and stood up, umbrella in hand. Mr. Justice Graves is still putting the boot in. Chief Inspector Brush is still referring to his unreliable notebook, and an 8-year-old Timpson has been banged up against her will, not in Eton College like you, Master Charlie, but in the tender care of the Crockthorpe local authority. The child is suspected of devil worship. Can you believe it? An offence which I thought went out with the burning of witches. Is that your case, Rumpole? Erskine Brown looked deeply interested. Indeed, yes. And I have a formidable opponent, none other than Ms. Liz Probert, with the full might of the local authority behind her. So, while there are still challenges to be overcome, let me tell you, Claude, and you, Charlie, what's it? Rumpole shall never sheathe the sword. Never. So I left the bar with my umbrella held aloft, like the weapon of a crusader, and the effect of this exit was only slightly marred by my colliding with a couple of trainee solicitors who were blocking the fairway. As I apologized and lowered the umbrella, I could distinctly hear the appalling Wisbeach say, "Funny old buffer." In all my long experience down the Bailey and in lesser courts, I have not known a villain as slithery and treacherous as Claude Erskine Brown proved on that occasion. As soon as he could liberate himself from the cuckoo he intended to place in my nest, he dashed up to Equity Court in search of our head of chambers, Samuel Ballard, QC. Henry, who was working late on long-delayed fee notes, told him that Soapy Sam was at a service with his peer group, the Lawyers as Christian Society, in the Temple Church. Undeterred, Claude set off to disturb the holy and devoutly religious Soapy at prayer. It was, he told a mystified Henry as he departed, just the place to communicate the news he had in mind. I am accustomed to mix with all sorts of dubious characters in pursuit of evidence, and when I bought a glass of Pomeroy's for a lack, member of the Lawyers as Christian Society, I received an astonishing account of Claude's entry into Evensong. Pushing his way down the pew, he arrived beside our head of chambers, who had risen to his feet to an organ accompaniment and was about to give vent to a hymn. Attending worshippers were able to hear dialogue along the following lines. Erskine Brown, have you joined us? Ballard was surprised. Of course, I've joined Lex. The subscription's in the post. But I had to tell you about Rumpole as a matter of urgency. Please, Erskine Brown, this is no place to be talking about such matters as Rumpole. Devil worshippers. Rumpole's in with devil worshippers, Claude said in a voice calculated to make our leader's flesh creep. However, at this moment, the hymn singing began, and Ballard burst out with, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Betraying a certain talent for improvisation, my informant told me that he distinctly heard Claude Erskine Brown join in with, Rumpole, in his mischievous way, has taken on a case about some devil worshippers. He had them in your place, your chambers, I mean. At which point, Ballard apparently turned and looked at the conniving Claude with deep and horrified concern. It was a time when everyone seemed intent on investigating the alleged satanic cult. Mirabel Jones continued to make films for showing before the juvenile court, and this time she interviewed Tracy Timpson in a room, also equipped with a camera and recording apparatus, in the children's home. Mirabel arrived, equipped with dolls, not glamorous pin-up girls, but a somewhat drab and unsexy family, consisting of a mum and dad, grandpa and grandma, who looked like solemn New England farm workers. Tracy was ordered to play with this group, and when, without any real interest in the matter, she managed to get grandpa lying on top of mum, Miss Jones sucked in her breath and made a note which she underlined heavily. Later, Tracy was shown a book in which there was a picture of a devil with a forked tail who looked like an opera singer about to undertake Mephistopheles in Faust. The questioning, as recorded in the transcript, then went along these lines. You know who he is, don't you, Tracy? Mirabel was being particularly compassionate as she asked this probing question. No. He's the devil. You know about devils, don't you? And she added, still smiling, you put on a devil's mask at school, didn't you, Tracy? I might have done, Tracy made an admission. So what do you think of the devil, then? He looks funny. Tracy was smiling, which I thought, in all the circumstances, was remarkably brave of her. Funny? He's got a tail. The tail's funny. Who first told you about the devil, Tracy? I don't know, the child answered, but the persistent inquisitor was not to be put off so easily. Oh, you must know. Did you hear about the devil at home, was that it? Did Dad tell you about the devil? Tracy shook her head. Mirabel Jones sighed and tried again. Does that picture of the devil remind you of anyone, Tracy? Still getting no answer, Mirabel resorted to a leading question, as was her way in these interviews. Do you think it looks like your dad at all?
In search of an answer to Miss Jones's unanswered question, I summoned Carrie and Roz to my presence once again. When they arrived, escorted by that faithful Bernard, I put the matter as bluntly as I knew how. At the mention of evil, Tracy's mother merely looked puzzled.
The devil? Tracy don't know nothing about the devil.
Of course not. Carrie's denial was immediate. It's not as if we went to church, Mr. Rumpole.
You've never heard of such a suggestion before? I looked hard at Tracy's father. The devil. Satan. Beelzebub. Are you saying the Timpson family knows nothing of such matters?
Nothing at all, Mr. Rumpole.
When they came that morning. When they came to get our Tracy?
Roz's eyes filled with tears as she relived the moment.
Yes, when they came for that. What did you think was going on exactly?
I asked Carrie the question.
I thought they'd come about that shop that got done over. Wedges, down Gunston Avenue. They had me down the neck time and time again about it.
And it wasn't you?
Straight up, Mr. Rumpole, would I deceive you?
It has been known, but I'll believe you.
Do you know who did it?
I asked Carrie.
No, Mr. Rumpole, no, I won't grass. That I won't do. I've had enough trouble being accused of grassing on Kerith Malloy when he was sent down for the Tobler Road supermarket job.
The Timpsons and the Malloys are deadly enemies. How could you know what they were up to?
My mate Barry Peacock was driving for them on that occasion. They thought I knew something and grassed to Chief Inspector Brush.
Would I do a thing like that?
No, I don't suppose you would. So you thought the old bill were just there about ordinary legitimate crime. You had no worries about Tracy?
She's a good girl, Mr. Rumpole. Always has been.
Roz was quick to remind me.
Always cheerful, isn't she, Roz? Her husband added to the evidence of character. I enjoy her company.
So where the devil do these ideas come from? Sorry, perhaps I shouldn't have said that. You know, Dominic Malloy told the social worker you taught a lot of children satanic rituals. You ever believed a Malloy, have you, Mr. Rumpole? In court or out of it?
Kelly Timpson had a good point there, but I rather doubted if I could convince the juvenile court of the wisdom learned at the Old Bailey.